Voilà, puis après, ben, le mois d'octobre arrive, le mois d'octobre, c'est l'automne, donc ça a été terminé, mais bon, l'automne arrive, puis l'automne, ben, c'est une autre, disons-nous que c'est une autre belle saison débute, et puis voilà. Donc, je vous dis au 28 octobre, et puis donc, à la prochaine.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from dramas to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Chauchaque. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, September 23rd, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests, Julie Tamiko Manning, co-creator and director of The Exchange at Centaur's Portico, on how to collaborate.
I've been working in theater for 30 years, and it's very often that I left rehearsal feeling a part of me was left in the rehearsal hall in a negative way. And it's the way that theater was, and this is the thing that I want to change about theater.
Andrea Pena and the team behind 6.58 Manifesto, introducing artificial intelligence to dance.
I was going to play her, actually, and I thought it'd be funny, but...
Hello, I am Vicky.
Ah, sorry. Vicky wanted to introduce herself.
And artist Peter James invites you to a five-hour show in which you can just take a moment.
Come on, everything is going so fast now, and faster and faster and faster. And I resist to that vitesse, and I say no. Let's stop that, and let's see how it feels in these atmosphere, ambience, moods of not doing anything but being.
Before we begin, some updates. More movement in local arts leadership. You'll recall that Mike Payette has passed the baton to Jimmy Blay at Geordie Theatre, and Guy Sprung has passed the torch to Zach Fraser at Infinity Theatre. Now, the artistic director at Black Theatre Workshop is stepping away after a decade in the role. It was announced just yesterday. Quincy Armourer says he's got new projects on the horizon, but that being the company's 13th artistic director has been a dream come true. Quote, I am incredibly grateful for the opportunity to work and play with the hundreds of artists who have shared their talents with the company for the past decade. Quincy debuted as an actor with BTW back in 1999 during a school tour of New Canadian Kid. Quincy also oversaw the company's 50th anniversary this past season, with special events held despite the ongoing pandemic. He's raised the company's profile across Canada, with BTW being appointed the first resident Black theatre company at the National Arts Centre in Ottawa, as well as leading big productions like Angélique, The Adventures of a Black Girl in Search of God, and The Mountaintop. BTW is the country's longest-running theatre company devoted to the stories of Black and diasporic communities, and it's based right here in Montreal. A big thank you and best wishes to Quincy. It's going to be a big job finding the person to fill his shoes. And I wanted to mention a great event happening Saturday afternoon. Every year, Infinity Theatre holds Write on Cue, a playwriting competition. This year, they held their first youth competition, The Right Stuff. The winners were announced earlier this summer, and now they are getting the professional staged reading treatment. Five plays will be presented, including three honorable mentions, as well as the runner-up, Withered Flower by Zoe Solange-Jabert of Villa Maria High School, and the winner, Elephant in the Room by Sinead Chapdelaine of Westmount High. This will be held at Drolet Rochelle Park in the Plateau from 2 to 5 on Saturday. The event is free with pre-registration. Visit infinitheatre.com and excited to hear the next generation of playwrights. Now, 2 weeks ago on this show, you heard from Ida Holmes, artistic director at Centaur, laying out the upcoming season, and the very first part of it arrives tonight. It's the launch of The Exchange, a free 20-minute live interdisciplinary performance taking place on the portico at the Centaur in Old Montreal, wherein a party of travelers attempt to reawaken a character in stasis, a statue, with the subtext of exploring theater creation and performance. This is a return of sorts to a wonderful fall concept the Centaur set up last year, titled The Portico Project, series of short shows performed outdoors, but it was canceled as the second wave reared its ugly head. As you might know, the Centaur's classic architecture, the stone, the soaring Roman columns, used to house the city's stock exchange. So the three people who were commissioned with carte blanche to create a work for the outside of it, they chose a title that acknowledges this history. So that's why the show is called The Exchange. E.O. Sharp and Nello Cianibruce are the co-designers of the project, along with their third partner, Julie Tamiko Manning, who directs. Julie, who is also an actor, spoke with me yesterday. Welcome to Upstage, Julie. Thank you for taking the time. How are you doing as you gear up for The Portico Exchange?
Yeah, I'm doing well. We have our last tech rehearsal tonight, and we open tomorrow. Yeah, so really looking forward to it. I'm hoping that the weather cooperates.
I hope so as well.
Yeah, thanks.
Will the performers at least be covered by the actual portico? It's more concern for the audiences?
No, actually, they spend a lot of time on the steps, as well as just in the front of the portico, which I don't think is like super well sheltered, but and they have drums. So there's three drums in the piece. And I know that there's some concern about getting that wet, but they have plastic bags. They're armed with transparent plastic bags.
So it's a rain or shine production.
It is. And I think that, you know, like with any show, the technicians are going to call it if there's too much water for all of the instruments, because, of course, they've got all the cabling and the speakers and lights out there.
Of course. I want to start with the name of the presentation, because there's a lot of meaning to it and a lot of thought that went into it. The Exchange. Mm-hmm. This is a hat tip, a nod to the old space that the Centaur used to be.
Absolutely. When we first met, Ida Holmes, the artistic director of Centaur, commissioned myself, Nello Cianibruce, and E.O. Sharp to come up with a show. The three of us were on the jury last year for the Portico project, and so we went through all of the submissions and we juried the shows that had applied. And then Ida just was like, "I'm just going to commission you all." So when we were thinking about it at first, and we're like, what are we going to call it? Because of course, the people who work in publicity need to know the title. So this is a really interesting thing about the way we make theater, is that we're all in this together, like the people who work in admin and in the office and on the creative side and the technical side and the promotional side, and people need things by a certain time. So we kind of had to like think about the title, and we're like, well, we really liked the idea of exchange, thinking how we want to go forward, making theater sort of, I mean, at the tail end, hopefully, slash post-pandemic, because we've all spoken in the last year and a half about the things that are kind of broken in the entertainment and theater and film world, and how do we want to change those things moving forward, and one of those things is exchange, and really looking at the not only the hierarchy of theater, but what actually happens on the stage. And so this was, and creation is not a new thing at all. And company creation is not a new thing, but it's something that we really wanted to experiment with and say, we have this idea, here are the bones, let's really create it in rehearsal. And so that's what we did, because we wanted there to be a live exchange every performance on stage. We tried to build it around that idea.
I'm speaking with Julie Tamiko Manning, who is one of the co-creators, co-directors of The Exchange, which begins at the Centaur this weekend and next. You are working with Io and Nalo Soyidi. Bruce, you were just referenced their names a little bit earlier on. I'm really curious to know how the creative process worked, because you've been referring to that, between three people. How does everyone contribute and shape this image together so that everyone's on the same page and everyone agrees? Not to mention the fact that you've got five performers who are also kind of expected to shape the vision.
So working in a co-leadership situation is really interesting, especially when we're coming from a place where we all have the roles that we do traditionally. Traditionally, I am an actor and a writer, and Nalo and Io are traditionally designers. And so I feel like we weren't doing anything sort of out of our wheelhouse, like out of our experience. However, right. the way that we sort of worked on it from the beginning is that all decisions were made by the three of us, and we always checked in together. And it's really not a new idea to work collaboratively this way. But there's something that we really wanted to sort of explore in terms of exchange on the creative level as well as on the performative level. I don't know if I said this before, but when you work in a new way, you're always going to, or very often you'll not get it on the first try or the second try. So I think that there has to be an understanding that we're going to try things. We're going to try things with the goal of working together. And if it doesn't work in one way, we have to sort of think of another way that it's going to work. So, I mean, in the end, even though we were all co-creators and we all kind of talked about the idea, because I have experience writing and creating stuff, I went home and took those ideas and wrote some bones for a script. And the other thing is it's not text-based. And it was very much created in the rehearsal hall with the creators, the performers. So they are creators as much as we are. And then, you know, Io and Nalo came up with the design because they are designers. That is their wheelhouse. I think that there was an understanding of what roles we were going to eventually play in this co-creation.
So what does it mean to, you know, as you were saying, get the bones in, did some writing at home and then you brought it to the rehearsal space. What are you putting on paper and then bringing to the team and then building on?
Well, there was an idea, the idea that we came up with that was based on an experience that I had had. And we hashed it out, we talked it out, and we figured out, okay, this is the beginning, this is the end, what's going to happen in the middle? And so in order to actually give some structure to the performer, so I'm not actually asking the performers to just do something, just go ahead and do something. So we wanted to give them some kind of structure. So without trying to be too prescriptive, which is really hard, to not be too prescriptive, because you have to kind of start somewhere. So I did start somewhere, and then I sent it out to them and I said, look, this is just a starting point. And so if there's anything that you disagree with, that you want to sort of change in the rehearsal hall, we tried to be super open. That was always the way that we started the day. We started with a check-in, and we always wanted to be super receptive to what everybody had to say. So hopefully we achieved that. I think that we did. A really big thing for me was for people to go away from rehearsal and not feel like they've lost something in the process. Because very often, I mean, you know, I've been working in theater for 30 years, and it's very often that I left rehearsal feeling a part of me was left in the rehearsal hall in a negative way. And it's the way that theater was. And this is the thing that I want to change about theater, is that we don't actually have to give anything up, that we can leave and leave in a better place, having learned something from each other.
A really intriguing and hopeful idea that I hope other people will pick up on. I'm speaking with Julie Tamiko Manning, who is one of the co-creators of The Exchange, coming to the Centaur's outdoor venue, the portico outside of the theater, this weekend and next. The concept at the beginning is quite simple. We have a group of travelers that come to a performer who is like a statue, someone who's not moving. Can you tell me just a very tiny bit about this, where the story progresses from there, and what that meaning that you're trying to get across to the audience in just 20 minutes?
Yeah, I know it's not a long time to, I mean, the story, if the story is not clear to the audience, then I think that that's okay too. You know, it could just be entertaining. I mean, it could just be that people choose moments where, and that's the thing about theater too, is that not everything is the most amazing, perfect thing, but there are moments, there are like brief moments, sparks, in live performance that really stick with you and resonate when the whole show did not necessarily. Those are the things that I love about theater. But where it does go, and it's a very simple story. There's a group of travelers, and they notice this woman who is a performer, a classical actor, and she is on stage and she's stuck in a statue position. And so they try and release her from that position.
Yeah, and her moment of immobility. I want to reference very quickly, just like the three co-creators, yourself included, the performers all come from widely different backgrounds and skill sets. We have Marilyn Sherry, who is an actor, improviser as well. These are five very different people on stage. Can you tell me about maybe just what each person brings very briefly?
Yeah, for sure. I think that everybody brings more than what they were cast for. When we were casting, I think that we were looking specifically for people who were incredibly different and diverse. And at the same time, I was looking for a percussive element. So three of the performers, Sandra Kadowaki is she's not a theater performer. However, she has performed for 10 years with Adachi Daiko, which is the Japanese drum group of Montreal. And Kyan Quealy is, he founded and is the leader of Montreal Steppers. Corinna Hodgson is a playwright and a disability advocate. Ainsley McNeeney is a drummer and a singer. And Marilyn, as you said, is a theater performer and a theater creator as well.
It sounds like such a stellar team, and I'm so excited to be on stage, to be there with Jim Disney's outdoor performance.
Yeah.
are you going to be there throughout the first weekend?
I am certainly going to try and be there. I will be there Thursday for sure. I'm going to try and be there for all of them. I might not be able to, but
there's a lot of performances. Well, Julie, thank you so much for taking the time to let us look behind the scenes at The Exchange. It's much appreciated.
Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
That was Julie Tamiko Manning, the director and co-creator of The Exchange, held outdoors at the Portico outside Centaur Theater. Her co-curators are E.O. Sharp and Nello Sayini-Bruce. The show is free and performed twice an evening at 5:30 and 7 Thursday to Saturday, this weekend and next until October 2nd. Also, it's free. Space is limited, though, so reserve your spot in advance at centaurtheater.com or 514-288-3161. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come, a five-hour show from a man who says he can do whatever he wants because he has no ambition left. Choreographer Andrea Pena's new show, 6.58 Manifesto, is a team effort. She's got 9 dancers, a soprano singer on stage, a video team, as well as an unusual collaborator, Vicky, a computer program that takes Andrea's work and then interprets it in an original way every performance, instructing the performers on every move. Andrea leans into her training in industrial design for her work, and this piece is a complex comment on artificiality in society, challenging our notions about sentience and everyday interactions. 6.58 Manifesto was performed live this month at the Agora de la Danse as a live show, but a team has created a lovingly adapted video version for you to watch at home as of tomorrow. Andrea joined me last week, along with her co-director and longtime collaborator Bobby Leon and cinematographer Antoine Ryan, who is a recent addition to the team. And heads up, Vicky herself makes an appearance. Andrea, Bobby, and Antoine, thank you so much for being here on Upstage. Really appreciate your time. How's everyone today?
Good. Thank
you.
Good.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the fall season. It's like la rentrée for the cultural scene. And here you are working on a show that is already sold out, but will be available online very shortly. I just want to get a general vibe check, a feel from everybody. Andrea, maybe we can start with you. Any feelings of anticipation as this project comes to fruition?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're absolutely excited. Like, you know, we're doing this interview and we're mid rehearsal as well. The dancers are on stage. We're teching the beast is coming to life, which is really exciting. And I mean, I think more than anticipation, it's been 5 years we've been working on this piece. So it really is like the birth of 5 years of work, 5 years of research, reflections that I think this piece encompasses so much more than the work itself. It really encompasses like a lot of just a lot of the essence of APNA in itself. So it feels like a huge moment actually going into this, the birth of Manifesto.
5 years is a long time to kind of bring that something. Now you're finally seeing it on stage. How do you feel when you're in rehearsal, as you are now actually, and seeing your 9 dancers on stage?
You know, it's evolved. The work's evolved a lot. Like it went from 5, then it went to 6, and now it's 9. And so it's a piece that's been like constantly evolving, I think, along with how we evolve as artists, how we evolve as collaborators with each other. And I think, you know, to see 9, especially after a year and a half of pandemie, to see 9 people on stage right now in the theater is just like overwhelming. You know, it's super beautiful. And they're like an incredible team, and these human beings are so, so beautiful as well.
It's funny because we've talked about shows that have reduced the number of people in them, or have choreographers that have hired dancers that are in family bubbles or in relationships to be on stage. And here you say that you've actually added dancers. Was the adding of people on stage something that happened pre-pandemic or during it, or?
Yeah, it actually happened during for the film. So when we were shooting for the film, I thought, hey, let's add up the number of dancers, because we shot in a plane hangar and we had a huge space. And then it just really clicked with 9. So we said, okay, let's see if we can put 9 people on stage and keep going with that amount of bodies on stage.
There's also other characters aside from your dancers. You have a singer, a soprano, and you also mentioned the techno music, the soundtrack as being kind of characters on stage. Can you tell me, perhaps you or Bobby can tell me a little bit about that?
About the characters, for the music, you mean? Yeah, well, I mean, I think Andrea is a better place to answer this question than myself. But I will say that within the film, it's been really interesting to focus on bringing those characters to life, because some of them are invisible, and how do you give life to something that you don't see through the visuals? So that's been an aspect that's been super interesting to explore in the film. And I think that in a sense, it kind of give something a bit different when you watch the piece and the film separately, which is always like a nice Easter egg to have.
these other players, we call them, or like agents, is well, there's the kind of presence of electronic music that is very particular to a tableau. There is in the film, actually, there's an actual DJ who's in the film in that section on stage. No, but there's the opera singer, and actually the third agent is we call her Vicky. And so the first tableau is all dictated by live code that is being sent out live from my computer onto the speakers in the room. So the dancers are actually responding to live commands from a code that we've built, and we call her Vicky. So she's also part of the shebang.
Does Vicky change the commands per show as each?
Yeah, it's absolutely at random every single night. So in the 5 years we've ran the show or that section, it's never been the same.
I'm wondering, Andrea, what made you want to work with a computer, a code with Vicky?
I'm an industrial designer, so I'm also doing my master's in industrial design. And, you know, like I have a digital technical practice, a technological practice, let's say, or I work with other mediums in my design practice. So I'm curious about how to push choreography to the sense where I can remove myself as the person who writes the choreography that is fully scripted and say, well, what does it look like to write choreography in code? What is code language? How do we choreograph code? And then like give the freedom or give that not control, but give the agency to the machine for her to choreograph a piece live in front of an audience. You know, like I press play and the code runs for 20 minutes and like I have me or the dancers have no control over what's going to happen. So there's a really interesting questioning of like the relationship of humans and technology, but also like how far can we push choreography if I'm removed from the equation?
Speaking with Andrea Pena, who is the choreographer of 6.58 Manifesto, also joining us, Bobby Leon, who is the co-director, and Antoine Ryan, who is a cinematographer. I'm just curious if there's any kind of snafus or pitfalls that can emerge with working with an algorithm, with a code like Vicky, anything that you didn't anticipate that might be a snag in rehearsal that you kind of had to puzzle or work out before a live performance.
Oh my God, all the time. I mean, the code's been written like 20 times because like timing changes, dramaturgy changes, like rhythm changes. How often does she call things? Is she being too slow? Is she being too fast? Like, is she glitching? Did the code not work? Like, there was a whole process of choreographing the code as if, you know, she's a performer before the thing was ready to run. And like now it runs very smoothly, but it was definitely a trial and error to figure out like, how do we communicate dramaturgy and time through a machine?
Do you ever get someone who's a purist who might say, wow, like why would you bring a code or a computer into something that is supposed to be natural and human?
Not yet. Not yet. I mean, I think people are curious about technology, and I think in dance we fear technology, or the milieu fears use of technology, because there's this maybe a hesitancy towards like, is it going to replace what we do? But for me, it's really about using the intelligence of the technology and saying, how can I use that intelligence rather than it be a medium that replaces something else? It's like the technology is much more than the apparatus itself. It's a way of thinking.
Yeah, and it enhances and it changes something that we're used to seeing. It creates a different spin on things.
Mm-hmm. But you know, what you were questioning, it was like really hard because for the film, you know, working with Bobby and Antoine on the film, it was really, you know, the code in the in the show is always different. And so when we're shooting the film and we're shooting like a static version of this object that has to be repeated because Antoine and Bobby have like three cameras and there's like a side angle and a crane and then a top view, and how do we work on that? Like, how do we reproduce? Because when you work in film versus when you see a live show is really different. So that was, I think, a big thing we had to like negotiate, the three of us, is like, how do we shoot something that is improvised?
Mm-hmm. I'm very curious about that, because oftentimes when you're making a finished film project, you need to do lots of takes, right? I think of a lot of theater companies that have had to kind of digest like, well, if we do it in one shot, is that really theater? But we have to put it online and have a film, but can we retake things? So it's really you know, that perfectionist side of things to really make it the best. So Antoine, can you tell us about how you approached that? Obviously this is a collaboration, but I want to hear from you as a cinematographer.
Yeah, I think like at first there had a lot of questions about how you'd cover things just based on the fact that, you know, as usual, we don't have enough time and blah, blah, blah. But what was cool is like the shows, like everyone's so good and the dancers were all so good that it, there's no such thing as like, ooh, that's not a good take. Like, you know what I mean? So it was, it felt like it was mostly just making sure you were able to get whatever was happening, like at least frame it so that it would be part of it. But yeah, it was mostly, that part wasn't a challenge, I don't think. So
have you had a lot of experience filming dancers and dance pieces?
I wouldn't say a lot, no. So it was a long time coming because I really wanted to, and I'd worked on a few projects but not as cinematographer for them. So yeah, I was ready. It was great. I was looking forward to it. And plus, especially that it was that high quality, you know, it wasn't just like some quick thing that was planned in a few weeks. It was like literally shooting 5 years of work, you know, and perfection. So it made the job much more, not easier, but a lot more like rewarding. You know, you really felt that you were getting something that had been, you know, distilled down to its best version. So that was dope.
That is the voice of Antoine Ryan, who is the cinematographer for the filmed version of 6.58 Manifesto. Also joining us is choreographer Andrea Pena and co-director Bobby Leon. So let's talk more about the filming process. How does Vicky get depicted for audiences watching at home?
I mean, in the film, we had Vicky play out loud on speakers for the dancers. And so when we were recording that section, actually, this piece is really interesting in the sense that, like, whenever you watch all three tableaus back to back, there's a natural progression in terms of physical demand. And to arrive to a certain point in the third tableau where everybody's physically pretty much exhausted, but they're kind of at the peak of the piece, right? So in the way that we decided to film this piece, we had to take that, to keep that in mind, to make sure that the performance aspect of the piece was still, close to how it feels when you're watching the show, right? We didn't do a million takes to get to the final product. We really made sure that we got at least two runs of each section and kind of navigated the dancers' energy so that their performance level was up to par with the performance itself. So when we were working with Vicky in the first tableau for the film, we had pre-recorded a version of her speech, and we had to work with it twice. Otherwise, it would have been impossible to edit the process because it would have never been the same. We would have never gotten the same takes. And then it would have been a nightmare for the editing part because it's a very, very active and very fast-paced tableau.
She also, we materialized her as a camera. Remember? So that was a big conversation that the three of us had, is like, how do we materialize Vicky? Like, she's such a thing. And Antoine was like, do we 3D render her? Like, is she this like weird 3D rendered glob? And so we thought, like, how do we like go and search for Vicky as a presence? And Jonathan Saucier, who's like the scenographer for the show and like in the film, he had the idea of bringing like a little tiny security camera. So in the film, like, you see there's a teeny kind of security camera that's like constantly flashing. So it's not literal, but like, if you would want to search for Vicky somewhere in the film, like, she is this kind of security camera who's in the background.
I guess it was important to embody her because when you're watching it live, you're going to be hearing her commands, right? But in film, you're not really situating yourself in a live space. You really have to embody her.
Mm-hmm. And we didn't show the camera a lot. We probably showed the camera only once just to have a mental imprint. Otherwise, we would focus too much on the object of Vicky over her commands. So the aspect of the concept of surveillance, which is very present in the first tableau because the dancers are navigating through commands, was a really interesting way that Jonathan brought Vicky to life in that sense.
I was going to play her, actually, and I thought it'd be funny, but...
Hello. I am Vicky.
Vicky wanted to introduce herself.
That is so wild. How do your dancers feel, Andrea, about getting, you know, work, like, obviously improvising during a show is not unusual, but getting your directions from Vicky, what is that like for them?
Obsessed. Like, they love it. They get to go and play. Like, they're literally playing a game on stage for 20 minutes. It's they really, I mean, they have parameters, things they can do, they can't do. There's rules, there's a game, there's like, it's like very, yeah, there's different rules depending on how the code progresses, but it's so clear. So the improvisation is not their responsibility, it's hers, and they just get to play.
I know artificiality, that's one of the things that you're exploring. How does Vicky play into, like, what are you trying to say about that in today's society? What statement are you making?
Yeah, I mean, I think we talked a lot about this too with Hugo Dalphon, who's like the lighting designer of the show, but really like a big right hand conceptually as well. And it was always a question of like, it never being about like human versus the machine or the machine against the human. It's really like our relationship to technology is much more complex than that. So, and the relationship of the dancers to Vicky and the commands change as the 20 minutes evolve. So it's really a question of like, how are we negotiating with technology? Like, what is the dialogue? Sometimes maybe it's imposing systems. Sometimes we're like pushing against it. Sometimes we're collaborating and really working together. So I think it's not one read, it's really like we try to encompass the different possible dialogues that we have with technology, good, bad, or neutral. So
And then, and regards to, since we're talking so much about the filmed version of things, do you worry that any of your message is lost because it's not being seen live by an audience, that we're seeing a mediated version of this improvisation?
Not at all. I mean, I really let like Antoine and Bobby take this over, but like they've done an insane amount of like an insane job as artists to really visualize the two-dimensional, you know, like screen version of this work. And when we finished and we had a screening all together, I thought, oh my God, is the film better than the real thing? Because they did such a good job. I mean, it's different and the real thing is amazing, but like really, really, like these two have like an amazing eye, and they can speak for it better than me, but it just, you have a proximity to the work that is so different than when you're seated in an audience.
Mm-hmm. I can tell this has been a very collaborative process, but for you, Bobby and Antoine, were you nervous at all to get Andrea's reaction as the choreographer to see your finished product? As she mentioned, you put a lot of work into getting the final product.
I mean, what I can say is that we were working all three side by side so closely during the process of filming. And on my end, having seen the piece evolve over the last 5 years, I gained quite an understanding of its intentions and its essence. And so in a way, it was, I guess, easier for me to be able to translate this to like a more of a visual language, and that Antoine like tackled like in such a magnificent way. But yes, these two pieces, they're pretty much two standalone pieces that speak of the same subject. You can go see the show and be at the edge of your seat and feel the viscerality of the work in real life. And then it's translated through images because we are able to get that physical proximity with the camera and the dancers. So you're still at the edge of your seat watching the dancers because you're able to be so close to them. And also translating the different concepts of the different tableaus. We shot in different ways for the first, second, and third tableaus in order to be able to translate those ideas and those feelings perfectly on screen.
I mean, I think that the cool challenge was trying to find a way to, you know, shoot it in a way that was like not necessarily like heightened or anything, but like more appropriate to a film medium, and, you know, bring the three-dimensionality into something. It's still 2D, but you still want to work it in ways. But not overdo it and still respect the piece as something that's meant to still live, you know, on a sort of stage. But the cool part about that is that Andrea was like, since we do have our cameras, we want to move around, let's make sure to like literally go on other sides of walls and literally go around stuff, almost as if you could go like backstage while seeing it. So you could see people walking towards the stage before they even were, you could notice them from the front. So all these cool things that like, we're more of like, let's play with this since we usually can't. And so that was really great. So we got the best of both, I think.
Mm-hmm. Really makes me think what you said. Like, it was so fun. I've actually worked with Antoine in the past 4, maybe 5 years ago. And sure. I feel the three of us are really intuitive and like really flexible. So we put this thing together like tight, but at the same time, we really worked in situ where it was like, we would go into the corner and be like, okay, what should we do? Because there's this cool bathroom thing. And so let's use it and let's shoot the thing from behind. So I think working with the flexibility that these two guys have, but also like quite a lot of trust with the three of us, that we were able, like Antoine said, to really go capture Manifesto from another perspective and be seated sometimes like from the perspective of the dancers, from behind the stage, behind, because there's these huge 10 feet by 40 feet long walls that are on stage and in the film. So sometimes we had, you know, the opportunity to capture like what inhabits behind those walls, which is something you wouldn't have the ability to really experience on stage.
And there was something fun too, like every time we would, I'd like pan over the camera and go too far and be like, oh no, you can see our screens. And Andrew was like, this is great, keep it more, like I, you know, and so that was cool.
Let me see the equipment. Yeah,
it was nice because then it's this new feeling of like you can't do wrong as long as you're doing something that you find cool, you know, so that was fun.
So the online version, the filmed version, gives you kind of more of a like behind the scenes look at things. It's like a DVD extra, which is really cool. I'm so wowed by the effort and the planning that went into turning a live experience, an improvised live experience, into something special for people watching at home. I have to thank the three of you so much for coming on to tell us more about your collaboration and your ideas here. I'm really excited to see it. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sarah. It's really nice to have the space to talk about the film. It's like you said, I think it's really a behind the scenes DVD, and for people to really think it's not a, you know, three cameras that are static recording a show on stage. It's absolutely a piece of work that's thought for the medium. And I think that's something we really wanted to ask ourselves is, in this digital age, like, how do we really think about dance on screen? And like Raph said, like bring that viscerality through the images. So it's really another object that like supports what people see on stage. And I recommend, like, if you see the show on stage, what you're going to see in the film is absolutely like a totally different experience as well.
That was choreographer Andrea Pena discussing her work 6.58 Manifesto with her co-director Bobby Leon and cinematographer Antoine Ryan, as well as Vicky, the computer program that shapes the live show. This performance was held live earlier in the month, but a quality video version is about to be available online for you to check out at home starting tomorrow until October 1st. Visit agoradance.com for more information. agoradance.com. I'm Sarah DeAy. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Peter James is an international interdisciplinary artist, comedian, dancer, director, and performer. He's worked with an array of companies and artists from Cirque Eloise to 4D Art to companies based in Belgium, France, and Toronto. His upcoming marathon work is titled Exorcisme Redemption Extatique, a 5-hour sit-down at La Chapelle Scène Contemporaine this weekend in the Plateau. Starting at 7 p.m., audience members can attend for one or more hours consecutively or intermittently. Peter has billed it as a dialogue performance slash interview slash conference slash testimony covering life, art, death, love, sex, a bold project, and a challenging experience for the audience. Various artists will be sitting down to interact with Peter during the show, and as he explained to me last week, he believes he is one of the very few brave artists left, and that hubris permits him to do whatever he wants. I spoke with Peter Light last week. Welcome, Peter, to Upstage on CKUT. Thank you so much for being here. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
I know you were... I'm doing really well, and I'm very excited to speak with you and to get to know you. You wear a lot of hats, performer, creator, writer. What was the first job you ever did, or how did you first see yourself as an artist?
Mm-hmm. I started, it wasn't written in my hand, in my destiny, that I was going to be an artist. I come from a very, very... violent and very poor milieu, which we call in the Marx terms sous-proletarien. Mm-hmm. So, but at the age of 20-ish, some people were telling me, Peter, you should go in art, you should go in art. So I went to the mime school, the Mime Omnibus Mime School, you know, Mm-hmm. And then I met people there, and it never stopped since that. So I guess I was made for that.
There's never any doubt. Now we are speaking to you because of Exorcisme Redemption Extatique coming to La Chapelle. And the fascinating thing is that each performance is a lot longer than the typical theater experience, 5 hours. And this is six hours.
What I mean, 5 hours for my thing with my group of people. And then there's one more hour at the end from midnight to 1 a.m. It's going to be a performance by two young performers.
Oh, wow. So tell me what your vision is for Exorcisme.
My vision of art altogether is like my life. You know, it's I take a lot of risk. Apart from Dave St. Pierre in Montreal, I don't know many people who really, really do art with taking a lot of risk and put themselves in danger. So I don't work in seduction. I don't work on charming. I don't work in racolage with the public. You know, it's like you guys are responsible for who you are and I am for what I do. I've been reading a lot about the La Divine Comédie de Dante.
Ah, you know? The 700th anniversary of his birth, I think, this year, if I'm correct.
Yeah, you are.
Okay.
And I've been reading not the Divine Comédie itself, but intellectuals mm-hmm. like Philippe Solers and others talking about it. Because, I mean, it's a very cryptic writing. It's very poetic and it's very Christic. So I've been reading a lot about that because I don't know why, but I feel very in some of my knowledge and culture, I'm very biblical. You know what I mean? And that those words for me are very truly important, like exorcism and redemption, especially. When I hear redemption, it resonates in me like it's always been like that. That word kills me. I love it. And then you have also ecstatic, because I don't know why. I think also with everything that's happening in our world at this possible end of the world, those words even resonate more than ever. You know what I mean? And I like the three words for the title because it's like a triptych or it's like a trinity, you know?
Right.
A trinity. And I feel close to that. And the work I'm doing now, it's all about duration. And it's gonna be hard for the public. It's gonna be demanding for the public what I'm gonna do, because sometimes there will be like tableau vivant where we don't do nothing for almost an hour. You know what I'm saying?
Wow.
So because I want us all to experiment that duration of time, because everything is going so fast now and faster and faster and faster. And I resist to that vitesse. And I say, no, let's stop that. And let's see how it feels in these atmosphere, ambience, moods of not doing anything but being, very much like I work in presence too. So it's going to be about being. And I think that can be in itself a very metaphysic experience, you know, for us all. There will be after that, though, things that will happen. There will be action. But that's my first statement when I start. Let's stop time.
Okay, I'm speaking with Peter James, the artist, and he presents Exorcisme Redemption Extatique at La Chapelle this weekend. When you said that you're going to pause for almost an hour, to me, it's like a protest, a protestation for everything that moves so fast in our world. So it's not just an art piece, but it's a statement.
It is. It's a statement. It's political. It's social. But it's also, don't forget, when we don't do nothing, we are present. And in that presence in which we will be doing almost nothing, we will be generating energy. We will be working by the inside being, you know, and that will resonate to the public. I know that.
Okay.
And the public will have to, at one point, they will have to. And don't forget, it's multi-layer. It's not just about doing that politically, but it's also artistically important for me, because it's like, I don't know, it's a fantastic. Also, it's almost, I think, you know, I'm 64. It's going to be maybe my two last shows. So I'm doing everything that I fantasm on for a long time, extremely, like I push it to the limits. And that's part of it. That's the first hour probably that we're going to do this tableau vivant for an hour without almost moving. But after that, there will things will happen.
Do you feel like you're running out of time? You said, I mean, 64 is not that old, I would say, but you feel like you have an impetus or a rush to put together everything you want to do on stage?
Yeah, well, especially, yeah, I feel a bit tired, and I feel that it's the time now to do something like that. And I do that for myself very selfishly, very egocentrically, but I do it for the community too, because right now I find that the artists in Montreal, we've had periods in Montreal where experimental was like total, you know, there was a lot of things going on and people weren't afraid to do things for 10 people in the public or 5 people in the public, and it didn't matter. Right now, I find that arts, in the artist world, in dance, in performance, and all the others, they are working for their grant demand. It's like always, am I going to have my next grant? Am I going to have my next grant? So I'm afraid, so I'm going to be nice and easy and polite for my show because I want my next grant. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
So that does show, the shows are beautiful, but I mean, substantially, I'm in total, I mean, it's a famine, it's terrible. So I'm doing this for them too, so that they can also eventually give themselves the permission to do something more more radical or just more themselves.
And you also talked about, you know, taking a moment to pause, and that'll happen on stage. So you've talked about in suspension, in silence. I'm assuming that's the part of the show that will be in silence, but you're also promising noise and fury, and there'll be other performers on stage with you. So when does the noise and fury component come in?
It's going to be a bit, it's probably because, you know, we don't rehearse at all. There's zero rehearsal.
Right.
So that's part of the risk too, you know, and I know that probably everybody is afraid right now or in a state of fear or hyper excitement. But because there's the compositeur de musique actuel, his name is Eric Dorion, and he does noise. That's his specialty, kind of. So and his music, I love noise. I love Merzbow, the Japanese, and I mean, noise for me is the best music of the world, because it's like if you were sometimes in hell, sometimes in purgatory, and sometimes in paradise. So
a little nod to Dante there again.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why, you know, during the tableau vivant, the beginning, there's going to be three music, one by Merzbow, the noisemaker, and that's hell for me, and one by Martin Feldman, because that's suspension, and that's purgatory. I find Martin Feldman in purgatory. And the last one will be by Eliane Radig. She's a French, she does drones music. She's been doing that for over 50 years. And it's very paradise sounding for me, what she does. So there will be moments of chaos. There will be moments of nothingness. And there will be moments where I will speak with the people, the public, all together. There will be discussion about art too.
Yeah, so how do you decide, with no rehearsal in advance, how do you go about deciding how you're going to compose your questions and what you're going to ask about? Do you do that in advance, or does that just happen on stage?
I have an advance for sure. I wrote a lot. I write, like, we don't rehearse, so I do all that here with my paper and pen. And, I mean, I've been working on that for a year and a half. So I have a lot of drawers in which I have my reserves and my surprises and my answers and my questions. So we're going to talk about art, life, sex, death, and you know, things like that. But people are going to be able to talk with me. There's going to be an open mic for them to talk with me, or just in private. And so during that that period of the show, people will be able to get out and go out, smoke a cigarette, listen. There's going to be performer doing things on stage too during that. So, and the music of Eric, some other music that I will put. So it's going to be, I'm very, 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 very excited and happy to do something like that, because it's rare in a lifetime. And it's like, you know, we always talk about freedom, des droits de l'homme, let's free le droit individuel. And I find that what I do is about that too. I want to free us.
I'm speaking with artist Peter James, who presents Exorcisme Redemption Extatique this weekend at La Chapelle. It's going to be a 6-hour show. You said earlier that you find that there's not enough risks on stage, and you're hoping to kind of inspire people to do more and to maybe go out more on a limb after they see this show. I'm wondering what you hope the audience, maybe the ones who aren't artists and may not be creatives, what do you expect them to take away from this?
I think it's the same thing for them too. I mean, when I watch, like, for instance, if you watch a kid, a 3-year-old kid, how free that kid can be, you know, doing, sleeping on the floor, yelling, crying, doing everything he or she wants, you know? I mean, I find that amazingly, it allows me to be free too, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, it's the same thing for me. Like, I know the public who are not artists, who come to those shows anyways, are public averti. In general, they already know about performance art, art experimental or art contemporain. And I think it's going to be the same thing, you know. And of course, the doors are open. If they don't like it, they can always leave, you know. and that's okay with me. You know, that's part of the game. Not everybody can agree or like what you do. But again, I'm not into making a good show or a beautiful show or that. For me, it's just to be there on the moment present, and we'll see what happens. And that's going to ask the public to be awake, alert. You know, they're going to have to be active in their own way, because it's going to be demanding a little bit.
Yeah, and also speaking of demanding, it's 6 hours long. Is having a longer period in the space, is that like just hoping that they're, you know, leaving space for more odd things, wild things to happen? Or are you really trying to force this idea that you've got to be present for long periods of time? Like asking a lot of your audience.
Yeah. I'm asking a lot to us all, actually. And it's about, for me, everything I do is about initiation. So the word initiatic for me is part of the happening, because really it's a happening night. And for me, I feel that if we let ourselves go into that, we can go into living things, something that is in the order of initiation. You know what I'm saying? A rituals of initiation. And that's important for me. If I was a public, I'd be happy to go there.
I'm wondering for you, with a show that is so obviously planned for, but it will be improvised and it will be long. You know, have you foreseen or planned, you know, if something goes off the rails or it doesn't go the way you, the ringleader, wants it to go, how do you kind of get it back on track or into a place that you want it to go to? Will that even happen, or will you just let things flow?
It's going to depend on the general atmosphere, but I'm ready for everything. So of course, as I told you, I've been working on that for a year and a half, and I think I'm ready for anything to happen. And if something doesn't happen, and it's like, I hope there's going to be some, you know, moments where I'll be lost. I want to be lost. I want to lose myself and everybody else, and I want to recuperate that moment, because when you're lost and when there's a malaise, of course, we have to be present.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be an absolutely wonderful marathon. I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Peter, for taking the time to speak to us about your art and your views.
You're super welcome, and thanks to you.
That was artist Peter James. He presents Exorcisme Redemption Extatique at La Chapelle Scène Contemporain this Saturday and Sunday, September 24th and 25th. The 5-hour show starts at 7 p.m., but you can stay as long or as little as you want, or leave and return for consecutive or intermittent hours. Visit lachapelle.org or call 514-843-7738 for more information. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Tonight you heard Julie Tamiko Manning, co-creator and director of The Exchange at Centaur's Portico Project, Andrea Pena and the team behind 6.58 Manifesto, artist Peter James. A big thank you to my guests, You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under archives. Thank you to Jack Soler, spoken word coordinator, for making sure this show gets to air. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeA. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and ckut.ca. Have fun and stay safe.
Pop Montreal International Music Festival is celebrating its 20th anniversary from September 22nd to 26th, 2021. 5 days of music, films, art, crafts, panels, and more, featuring Cakes Tequila, Backwash, The Besnard Lakes, The Deers, Handsome Eli, and more. Tickets on sale now at popmontreal.com.
It takes a good dose of courage and perseverance to get through a pandemic.
True, but it also takes a good dose of patience, resilience, confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome to the Thursday, September 23rd edition of Grey Matters. Tonight from Alternative Radio, we have a lecture entitled Afghanistan, China, and the Decline of U.S. Power. It's delivered by Tariq Ali. He's an internationally renowned writer and activist born in Lahore, Pakistan. For many years, he has been based in London, where he is an editor of New Left Review. He's a charismatic speaker and is in great demand all over the world. In his spare time, he is a filmmaker, playwright, and novelist. He is author of many books, including The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Pirates of the Caribbean, Speaking of Empire and Resistance with David Barsamian, The Duel, Pakistan on the Flight Path of American Power, The Obama Syndrome, The Extreme Center, and The 40-Year War in Afghanistan, A Chronicle Foretold. This lecture was recorded in London, UK, in the September 9th, 2021. So, without further ado, here's tonight's lecture, Afghanistan, China, and the Decline of U.S. Power by Tariq Ali.
Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative is a gigantic economic plan to try and transform their world and create a link to Europe that is not dependent on anyone else. And they're, you know, here they're